Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and you're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World Around the World on Blog Talk Radio. I hope everybody's having a fantastic Thursday evening. A big hello to our listeners in New Zealand and England and Ireland and all across North America. Broadcasting from the massive studios here in Clinton Falls, Indiana. And as always, manning the Wild World News Desk, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Batson. So what's going on at the Wildlife Preserve this week?
Well, not too much. We're preparing for our school tour, which starts off in a couple of weeks, so we're getting ready for those activities, but nothing special really here tonight, so that's a good thing. That's always a good thing. Big thank you to our technical producer, Melissa Hovey, and Wayne Larson will be manning the chat room. They're from Butte Creek, Ohio, and they'll be taking care of all the phone calls and the various correspondence that will come through tonight. We also want to invite all of our listeners to become a friend of Larry Batson's Wild World News, and you can do that on the Blog Talk Radio site. And we invite you to do that as well. Tonight's guest will be along just a little bit. Hey, we're quite honored. We've been looking forward to this for several weeks. Donna Shaver from Padre Island, Texas. Well, I should really say the Padre Island National Seashore in Texas. And her fantastic work with the Ridley's Kemp Sea Turtle. And we're going to talk about the activities of releasing hundreds and hundreds of babies. Of course, the threat of this oil that came from Louisiana and some of the activities going on down there. So we're very excited. We've been looking forward to this for several weeks. We want to also remind everyone that next week on the program, Bill Yake is going to be here from Oregon. He's going to be talking to us about his recent expedition trip to the island Sulawesi in Indonesia, the Celebes Island formerly known as. And Bill will be here. We're very excited about that. He'll be joining us here on Larry Batson's Wild World. As always, manning the Wild World News Desk, Dr. Henry Day. Doctor, what do you have for us tonight?
Well, let's start out tonight in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where we've got some bad news bears.
Oh.
The State Game and Fish Department has captured a record number of bad grizzly bears this year. Now, the agency captured bears on 38 occasions as of August 27th to date. Now, they say excluding the Grand Teton and the Yellowstone Parks. Now, we've talked about the bad bears before, right?
Oh, yeah.
And well, what's the reason for the bad bears this year?
What are they doing?
Well, they're creating havoc, and apparently they're enough that they have to be captured and relocated.
Oh, well, it's their home. You know, it's the same old, same old. People do stupid things in their home. And grizzly bears are like the mountains. They don't care. That's their home. You're entering their property, their space, and you need to respect that. And that deeply, I know we've had a fatality this year in Yellowstone and a couple people that were injured, but as I was told by Bob Jackson, Yellowstone Park Ranger, who patrolled the Thoroughfare District, which is the most remote area of Yellowstone, and was in grizzly bear country for over 20 years, that the practice of outfitters and hunters that leave game that they've killed and they leave the meat there, they're just creating great, big, huge grizzly bear feeding grounds, and that's what's happening. So,
and we need to have him back on again because he had some great stories.
Bob will be on. He's always very anxious to join us, so we'll have him on here in the next few weeks and he can tell us a lot about grizzlies. He's had a lot of experience with them.
All right. Well, here's some good news.
Okay.
The bat disease may be thwarted. Now, we don't get to use thwarted very much. At least I don't. Anyway, listen to this. A scientist meeting in Boston said they may have found a new way to battle a fungal disease that's wiping out the nation's bats. Lab tests show several drugs can fight the germ, and some antiseptics might help decontaminate areas where bats live. And as you know, the people that go into the caves, their hands and their feet also can contaminate their dwellings. Well, researchers with New York's State Department of Health reported Sunday at a meeting at the American Society for Microbiology. Now, this last year, more than 1 million bats have died from the fungal disease, which is called the white nose syndrome. And it's found as far south as Tennessee and as far west as Oklahoma. And we know bats pollinate a lot of our fruits and vegetables. Very important. But this is good news.
Yes, it is. I wonder if some of this could be contributed to the climate change.
That's exactly what I believe, too. I think maybe there's a little more moisture in the caves now than there has been in the past. And
there has to be a reason behind it, some change in their environment, some change in the ecosystem. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops.
Speaking of bats, if you've never been to Carlsbad Caverns in New Mexico, it's a must-visit site. 650,000 bats leave the cave every night. It's a beautiful, spectacular event. Okay, off of the bats. Let's run off to Key Largo, Florida, where there's another problem going on. More than 100 divers collected 534 Indo-Pacific red lionfish during a concerted effort to reduce the population of the invasive species in the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary. The Reef Environment Education Foundation said unsuspecting pet owners are releasing the non-native fish into the Atlantic, where they have no predators. And we reported on this a few weeks ago. Well, I guess it's really gotten out of hand.
They're quite toxic, too.
Yes, they are. All right, well, let's head off to one of your favorite places, Colorado.
Oh, love Colorado.
Good news for wild horses. About 100 wild horses stuck for decades in a canyon-filled area in the northwest Colorado, could be gone by the end of next month. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management announced a new plan to remove the horses, which were separated from a larger federally managed herd in 1983, which happened when a highway expansion cut off the canyon.
Oh, doesn't it?
yeah, exactly. That's what I, what do you say?
Yeah, what
do All right, well, we're going to stay in Colorado. Now listen to this. Firms from around the world are competing to design a wildlife crossing that could be installed over Interstate 70 in Vail. The State Department of Transportation is working with the Western Transportation Institute at Montana State University on the contest. The finalists include firms from New York, Philadelphia, Toronto, and Amsterdam.
And they're building now, a crossing across the Interstate 70.
Yes. Now, as you know how animals perform, as you've had animals in very many different situations, what do you think about that? Are animals going to cross over a highway?
I don't know. I haven't seen what they're going to build. And what particular animals are they concerned about? Is it pronghorn? Is it elk? Well, they ought to be elk or deer, I assume.
Yes, yeah.
Huh. Well, I hope it works because, you know, gosh, I tell you what, an automobile running 70 miles an hour on Interstate 70, they hit an elk. That's bad news. I mean, that's just like
it's for everybody involved.
The elk and the passengers and the driver, I mean, it's just bad news. Many years ago, I was in Estes Park, Colorado, on a motorcyclist, and he wasn't doing 70. He's only doing about 35. He just saw a brown blur, and he hit an elk. He thought he'd hit a brick wall. And it spread him on down the highway. We kind of picked up what was left of him and took him into the hospital. But so I hope that's successful. Maybe they'll use that in other parts of the country if it is.
I agree. All right, now
I have to Colorado for doing it though, because that's got to be a very expensive endeavor.
Yes, at least for considering it.
Right.
All right. Now, if you live in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, get ready for an arachnid infestation.
Cool.
A wet spring and an abundant amount of crickets have resulted in a rise in the number of spiders this year. Entomologist Tom Royer said that the wet spring led to a large insect population, which spiders eat, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the most common spider in the state is the brown recluse, also known as the fiddleback.
Right.
Though rarely fatal, the bite can cause tissue to decay.
Yes, it's very bad.
Now, I don't know if you ever noticed, but on my right cheek, there's a little indentation. Well, that's from a black widow when I was stationed in the service in El Paso. Now, they were so abundant there that, you know, wherever you went, there were black widow spiders.
Yeah.
Now, one time I had the opportunity to fly. I was living here. Do you remember when we did the party for all the Holiday Inn owners across the United States?
Right.
Where you performed with Bob Denver.
And thank God I'm a country boy.
Wasn't that what, in the late 80s?
Yeah.
Sometime in the late 80s.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, they flew me to El Paso to get some paper mache parrots for this party. They were going to pay like $50 for them. I said, I lived in El Paso. I can get them for $6 a piece. Saved the company a lot of money. Anyway, the black widow spiders were so common there, I was leaving to go to the airport, and I was walking down this railway, and I thought, well, let me see if there's a spider around here. So I looked under the handrail, black widow spider right there, took a medicine vial, touched her, she went right in, I brought her home, okay? Anyway, in the late 80s, you were doing a cable show, Wild World of Animals.
Yeah.
And you were in my office one day and saw the black widow, and you invited me to be on the show.
Right.
And that's how common those spiders are. So the people that live in Oklahoma City, don't be alarmed. They're all around you. You know, just be aware that they're there.
You've just scared the hell out of most of Oklahoma. Do you know that?
Well, sorry to go on, but your cable show was great. That was the wild world of animals.
It was Amazing World. That's what.
Amazing World of Animals.
That's right. It was okay. Yes, it was.
All right. Well, let's head off to Wilmington, Delaware. Now, Roger, a 50-pound tortoise, was reported stolen Friday, this last Friday, from the Greenwood Aquarium store. But later he was found crawling between the nearby Green Bank Motor Apartments. And the brown and tan African cicada tortoise was hasn't roamed the store for like the last 15 years. And during the business hours, you know, while the store was open. And everybody, Roger's okay. He was reported in good health.
You know, we have three of those. One that weighs
almost
100 pounds.
And like I told you a few days ago, we had a windfall here, so there's pears everywhere. Come and get some pears for the tortoises.
Okay, I will.
All right. Now, here's one for you, Donna. Hatteras, North Carolina. There is a record year for turtles at Cape Hatteras. The National Seashore has come up with 153 nests this year. Six are the green turtles, and the rest are the loggerheads.
Well.
All right, well, let's finish up the animal news tonight. We've carried on just a little bit long. Let's go fishing, all right?
Okay.
Providence, Rhode Island. Now, listen to this. This is a pretty good idea. Federal and state officials are setting up a permit bank system to increase fishing opportunities for the state's small boat fishermen. The bank buys permits from fishermen who don't use the fishing days or catch their allowances. The banks then lease the fishing opportunities to the other small boat operators.
Well, that's great. Is that it?
That's it.
Okay. We'd like to thank Dr. Henry Day for the Wild World News, which is underwritten by Jet Kaiser Films. If you have a corporate film that you're putting together, a wedding, anything, he travels around the world. Go to his website, jetkaiser.com, K-A-I-S-E-R, And he's quite the talented artist when it comes to cinematography. That's Ted Kaiser. We also want to thank our other underwriters that keep Wild World in the news, such as We Want You Cottages in beautiful Chautauqua Lake, New York, Peter and Kathy Weimer. They are their proprietors. And also, they have a very exciting new kids fishing site called iKids Fishing, where youngsters from all across the country can download pictures of that big whopper that they caught over the summer. The website is www.wewantchu.com. Or give them a call. The season's about over, but they do have a lot of winter activities up there in the cold country of western New York at 716-789-3383. Also, a big thank you to McGregor Mountain Lodge in scenic Estes Park, Colorado. I call it God's country. Right on the borderline of Rocky Mountain National Park. Boy, I'll tell you what, they have spectacular places to stay, cabins, lodges. It's quite fantastic. Don't be afraid of the wintertime, because you can still get around, and I'm telling you right now, the weather is absolutely wonderful. It might snow 10 inches one day, and the next day be 60 degrees and sunny, and the roads are clear, and you have the place to yourself. Here's their website, info@McGregorMountainLodge.com, or use that 800 number, 1-800-835-8439. Also, a big thank you to Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina. And Lake Marion and Lake Moultrie, known as Santee Cooper Lakes, they cover 171,000 acres and 450 miles of shoreline. Known for world-class fishing, they hold 7 state records and 1 world record. Go to that website, www.santeecoopercountry.org, or call the girls. They'll line up your fishing trip, their guides, your places to stay, your boats, everything. That number is 1-800-227-8510. I want to remind everyone also, my website, the official Larry Batson website, it's very simple. LarryTheAnimalGuy.com tells all about our wildlife rescue work that we do. Also, our wildlife education programs that we take all across the country and visit hundreds of schools each year with our collection of wild animals, which include the baby olive baboon, which we're raising right now. And go to the website, lots of pictures of animals from past and present. That's LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. We've been looking forward to tonight's show for a long, long time. In fact, as I had mentioned earlier to our guests, Dr. Henry Day, is responsible for having on the show. One of the stories that he related to us was in regards to the fantastic work this woman has done in the Padre Island National Seashore in Texas, rescuing Ridley sea turtles. And, of course, now with the danger and threat of that big oil spill in Louisiana, we're going to hear all about it tonight. It is my pleasure to welcome to these airwaves all around the world and across North America, Donna Shavers here tonight. Good evening, Donna.
Well, good evening to you, and thank you so much for inviting me to be on the show tonight.
Well, I'll tell you what, when Dr. Day read your story, I called him right away. In fact, I didn't think I even mentioned during the broadcast. I said, we need to call her and see if she can be a guest, because she has a lot to tell us. And like Dr. Day says, we love those baby turtles. I know you do, too.
Well, I sure do. I've been working with Kemp's Ridley Sea Turtles at Padre Island National Seashore since 1980. So, obviously, they've captivated my heart as well as my working career.
Wow, 30 years.
Yes, sir.
That is fantastic. Well, tell us what's going on this season. I know with the threat of the oil spill in Louisiana, it's been a big, well, threat all across around the world. But what's the situation now?
Well, my work focuses primarily on the nesting beach for Kemp's Ridleys at Padre Island National Seashore, but I do also some activities with turtles found washed ashore and some other research projects with satellite tracking, et cetera. For Kemp's Ridley, it has been a challenging year. The oil spill was quite a concern to those of us who've studied and tried to preserve the Kemp's Ridley sea turtle. The Kemp's Ridley's life cycle is more tied to the Gulf of Mexico than is any other sea turtle, because it reproduces almost exclusively on Gulf of Mexico shorelines, whereas the others are more widespread in their nesting distribution. So a lot of concern about the adults that are in the Gulf of Mexico, as well as the foraging juveniles. The area where the oil spill is located, I've tracked many adult Kemp's Ridley turtles into that area in previous years, and there's also been work that has shown that that area is important for foraging for the juveniles. So a lot of concern about potential exposure of the Kemp's Ridley turtles to the oil, and there were some juveniles that were found oiled, both some alive and some dead as well.
How many? And what's the situation in the waters right now? What are you seeing as far as this oil spill?
Well, I'm over in Texas, and fortunately, we have not seen oil from this spill on our shorelines at Padron National Seashore.
Fantastic.
So we're very thankful about that. From what I understand, in the waters where the spill was located, very difficult to find the oil in the waters, but there is some concern that the oil may have settled into the sediments. And so there's going to be increasing focus of research, from what I hear, on looking in the sediments to see if there's oil there. And that also is a concern to Kemp's Ridley because their diet, as they mature, becomes increasingly focused on consumption of crabs, especially benthic crabs. And so if there's oil that's settled in the sediments, well, there could be some exposure through consumption of those crabs. Potentially not out of the woods yet, so to speak.
Well, we're going to cross our fingers and pray that the situation doesn't get dire. I mean, this has been a heck of an ecological impact, not only on the shorelines of Louisiana and Florida and Texas, but like we were talking earlier before the program, it's around the world. I mean, all the oceans are essentially connected in some remote way.
Well, it was a big spill, and a lot of animals were within the pathway, and so there's a lot of folks that have been concerned, but then I've got to say at the same time, a lot of biologists from various agencies and non-governmental entities and universities have been working really hard to try to get information on what the impacts have been and are setting up studies to try to look at impacts into the future as well and to try to do the best we can given the situation. But yes, it is certainly a concern to us.
How many turtles did you release this season? I'm looking at the press release. It said between 7,000 and 8,000. Is that correct?
Well, you know, looking at the positive side here, going to our nesting beach work, this year we released more than that. We released closer to, I don't have the final figures in front of me, but I think it's probably more like about 11,000 hatchlings Kemp's Ridley in Texas. Padron National Seashore is the most important Kemp's Ridley nesting beach in the United States. Most Kemp's Ridleys nest on the Mexican coastline, but in 1978 there was a program that was initiated to try to increase nesting of Kemp's Ridleys at Padron National Seashore to form a secondary nesting colony of Kemp's Ridleys there so that it would provide a safeguard in the event of an environmental or political catastrophe down in Mexico, so there'd be a safe area, a protected beach in the United States. And the National Seashore was selected because Kemp's Ridley is a native nester to the area and because we're under the national park system so we can protect the turtles and the habitat. So we've been working really hard since 1978 to try to increase nesting by Kemp's Ridley turtles there, and thanks to the hard work of many, many people, nesting has been increasing, and we had 140 Kemp's Ridley nests found in Texas in 2010, and 74 of those were at the National Seashore, and we incubate the eggs from most of the nests that are found on the Texas coast at Padron National Seashore. So from them, yes, we had, like I said, I don't have the exact tally in front of me, but I think it's over 11,000 hatchings that we released this year. So we're excited about that.
And my understanding is that you have a facility there where you basically, 24 hours a day, these babies are monitored. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
They get, Kemp's Ridley is the most critically endangered sea turtle species in the world, and we're really dedicated to the work we do, and we give the eggs a lot of care once we find them. We want to make sure that we can hatch as many of them as possible. So the we have an incubation facility at the National Seashore, and as I said, it receives most of the chemsurili eggs that are found on the Texas coast. And the eggs are very closely monitored, and the eggs are removed from the beach for protected incubation. Because of their critically endangered status, we want to protect them from a variety of threats on the beach, both human-related and natural threats, high tides, predators, and just a whole host of things that could impact on their survival, as well as the survival of the resulting hatchlings. So the eggs go into our facility, and they're very closely monitored for incubation temperature, because I'm sure you've dealt with this before. Also, the temperature determines the sex of the turtles, with warmer temperatures during the middle third of incubation producing primarily females. And the species is not monogamous, and so we want to produce a predominance of females, and that mimics the natural sex ratio. So we spend a lot of time trying to make sure we've got the right temperatures for that, as well as the temperature is important for the survival of the eggs. If it gets too hot or too cold or fluctuates too much, it can be lethal. So a lot of time is spent on that.
I remember when we used to hatch snake eggs, what we would do before we'd move them, we'd take a little felt tip marker and put a dot right on top of the egg, because our understanding was that if the egg rolled, the embryo inside would drown. Is that true with the turtles as well?
Same thing with the turtles. It's thought that the membranes attach about 24 hours after the eggs are laid, so we use extreme care when we're moving those eggs. When they're newly laid. And this year we had an early season hurricane, Hurricane Alex, and we had, in addition to the incubation facility, there's two other ways that the sea turtle eggs are incubated on the Texas coast, and they're both called a large screen enclosure called a corral. It's kind of like a super-sized dog kennel, big screen enclosure. But as Hurricane Alex came and threatened our shorelines, we removed the eggs that were incubating from those two corrals and very carefully brought them up the beach. One of those corrals was on South Padre Island, and the other was at Padre Island National Seashore, 40 miles down the beach with no road behind the dunes. This is all beach driving. And we were very careful getting those eggs that were well along in incubation, one by one into a box, and then inched them up the beach. And we had great, great survival. I don't think we lost a single embryo due to that, but you've got to use extreme care to not rotate the eggs for the sea turtle eggs, just like the snake eggs that you mentioned.
And people understand, you know, when you go to the store and pick up a chicken egg, that the egg is hard. Not so with the turtle eggs. It's a soft shell, correct?
That's correct. The eggs for the sea turtles are round in shape. Although there is a little indentation when they're laid, and they've got a kind of leathery shell. And when you think about it, that kind of makes sense, because as the turtle is dropping the eggs into the nest cavity, they're bouncing on each other. And if they were brittle or if they were totally just round and turgid, they could break. So this gives them a little bit of cushion as each one drops into the nest cavity. And the female turtle, it varies within the different species, but for chemsurili, they lay an average of 100 eggs at a time, and the chemsurilis nest an average of 2.5 to 3 times during a nesting season, and on average every other year.
So each nest will produce how many eggs?
Each nest is on average 100 eggs, and
wow.
She will generally nest more than once in a nesting season. So yes, they're large. The number of eggs at one batch is a clutch, so they're large clutches compared to many organisms.
Can I ask a question, Donna?
Do the
babies, do they have an egg tooth like on most of the saltwater terrapins?
Yes, they sure do. It's a little projection at the tip of the nose, and it's sharp. And that is the way that they pierce the eggshell, and the nose comes through first, then one front flipper, then the other, and the turtle crawls out of the shell. But it's very slow process. It can take 3 days from the time that the egg is pipped until the turtle is completely out of the shell.
That has to be the longest 3 days of your life, probably.
Well, again, these nests get tender, loving care because we want to hatch as many turtles as we can to help replenish the species and increase nesting there. So from the time that we have hatching, there is monitoring 24 hours a day. And in the old days, it used to be when we'd have 20 nests that we'd get from Mexico, and I was much younger back then, I would be the one who would stay for every night that we had hatching and every possible night that there would be hatchling releases. But now that we've got more than 100 nests that we're caring for in a year, I've got to get a little bit of help on those nights. I'm not there 24 hours a day, every single day anymore. I need to have a few people helping me. But they are long days, yes, until they're all released. It's long days.
That's our guest tonight, Donna Shaver. She's the National Park Service's resident turtle expert in Padre Island, Texas, in the National Seashore. We're going to take a short break, Donna, get you a cold beverage, or be back in about 5 minutes. Folks, you're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
There are some visitors you'd just rather not see. Like your obnoxious brother-in-law, Louie.
Hey, everybody, we're here. Good to see you. When do we eat?
But then there are some visitors you just can't get enough of. To make your farm or ranch a more attractive place for the visitors you actually want to see, contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office. They can help you build the habitat wildlife loves. But as for Louie, try disconnecting the doorbell. This message brought to you by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and this radio station.
We're Rascal Flatts. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Take me fishing and show me how to drive the boat.
Take me fishing so I can tell you what a great dad you've been.
Take someone you love out on the water and see where the water takes you.
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny, playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling.
What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, do you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters.
It's Bobcat, heavy. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow.
What's that supposed to mean?
Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everyone. This is Larry Batson. You're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio around the world. Our guest tonight, Donna Shaver's here with us. We want to remind everyone, sea turtle expert and from Padre Island, Texas. We want to remind everyone that we're underwritten by several folks that keep this program on Blog Talk and throughout the world on the Internet. We want you cottages up in Chautauqua Lake up in western New York. Peter and Kathy Weimer, what a resort they run. And they also have something very exciting. It's called iKids Fishing, where youngsters can download their picture of the big fish they caught over the summer and compare it to other young anglers all across the country and around the world. That website is www.wewantyou.com. Also, McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, God's country, right on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. And if you've never been to the western part of the United States and saw those magnificent Rockies, you owe it to yourself to go, and that's a hot place to stay in Estes Park. Their website is info@McGregorMountainLodge.com, or give that 800 number a call, 1-800-835-8439. Also, a big thank you to Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina. Lake Marion, Lake Moultrie, known as Santee Cooper Lakes, they cover 171,000 acres and 450 miles of shoreline. Known for world-class fishing, holds 7 state records. I'm telling you right now, I went fishing down there about 3 years ago. It's fantastic. You get on the boat, you put about 8 lines in the water, and when those big catfish hit that line, it is incredible. Anywhere from 10 to 100 pounds. It's fantastic. Here's that 800 number, 1-800-227-8510. Let the girls at Santee Cooper Country, they'll organize your whole trip, your fishing guides and your lodging and your bait, everything you need right there. Or go to the website, check it out, SanteeCooperCountry.org, also a hot place for those golfing aficionados, which I've never been able to figure out. But anyway, if you enjoy hitting a little white ball around in the grass, that's also an awesome place to go. And also my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and be sure you check out also my Sunday program. It's on RadioMom.fm. It's called The 70s on Sunday, where I play music from the 70s and also some of the latest music, and that's on RadioMom.fm, or go to my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and there's a direct link, and that's on every Sunday from 12 to 7. Our guest tonight, Donna Shaver, the work she's done is just unbelievable. It's fantastic. She's basically responsible, along with about 150 volunteers, I understand, for making sure a very rare endangered species, the Kemp's Ridley's turtle, is kept on this planet for many, many years and for generations to come. And it's such an honor to have her on with us tonight, some of the hard work she's done. She's been doing this since 1980 with 150 volunteers on the Padre Island beaches. Once they hatch, Donna spends nights monitoring the babies right there in her office. In fact, I guess she has a little special alarm clock she hangs around her neck and wakes up on the hour to monitor these baby turtles. In other words, she's quite dedicated, and gosh, it's such an honor to have her here tonight. So what does your day consist of today, Donna?
Well, right now, the hatching for the Kemp's Ridley is over. We've got a few loggerhead and green turtle nests under our care, but the bulk of the egg incubation, patrolling, and hatching releases is over for the year. So now, unfortunately, the bulk of the day is at the computer. But
oh,
it won't be long before we'll be back on the beaches.
Is there a website where people can and look at your activities and also possibly contribute to your work?
Well, there sure is a website. It's our website for Padre Island National Seashore. It's www.nps.gov/PAIS. And that's the first two letters of Padre, first two letters of Island, PAIS. And on there, there's an icon of sea turtles, and they click on that, and I've got a directory that goes into all the different programs that we're involved in with the sea turtles at Padre Island National Seashore, as I said, from dealing with the stranded ones washed ashore to our work with satellite tracking, some of my previous studies with netting and foraging ecology, to the mainstay of our work, which is with the nesting for the Kemp's Ridley. And when it comes hatching time again next year, we encourage the public to get on our website, and we will post the projected release time for the nest that we find, and we invite the public to come out and watch about 20 to 25 of our releases that are held each year. They're open to the public free of charge. In 2010, we had over 5,000 people that came just to watch these releases, and many of them come from all over the country, and we even get some from overseas that tell us that they've planned their vacation around coming to see one of these remarkable hatchling releases. So people will be able to read about that opportunity that will start again next year. The very end of May to the beginning of June will be when the first releases will be held next year. So people can read about that and our other work. And also there's a new feature that the National Park Service is working on for a few parks, which is going to be a button that people can click on our website if they wish to donate. That feature's not on there yet, but it's soon to be added to our website.
It has to be inspiring to know that the young people that come to watch this, that you are going to have a future generation of biologists and naturalists and people that may not be working with particularly the sea turtle, but some way helping this planet, the natural world of this planet. And I know that the National Park Service, and I know for sure because we've had several guests on our program from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, that they're quite worried about the future generation of young people spending too much time indoors in front of computers and televisions and Game Boys and all the iPods and all that, and they're not having a chance to actually experience this outdoors, to love it just like people like you do and myself as well. So I bet to see the look on these youngsters' face has to be quite rewarding as well as watching these turtles go into the ocean.
Well, you're exactly right about the concerns that the National Park Service has about this, and it is tremendously rewarding to see the young people as they watch these hatchlings take their first steps in life and go away in their lifelong journey, which is full of perils for these tiny turtles that are on their own, no maternal care whatsoever in the wild, and the care that they've gotten for us is it, and the children enjoy the releases so much, and it's just wonderful to see their expressions on their face, and I will see some of them years later. They come back, and it's dating me, but I'm starting to see some of them come back now with their own families, and it's great. It's great to see the education taking hold and becoming more interested in the environment overall, and hopefully, you know, amongst those, maybe we'll have a few budding sea turtle biologists too, because we're gonna need more of those in the future as well.
Now, I don't think we had mentioned this earlier. How large or how big are the baby turtles when they're released?
Well, the hatchlings are about the size of a silver dollar. They're quite small.
Wow.
Potentially hatchlings, yeah. They're very, very small and vulnerable to predators. There's big crabs that we've got in Texas called ghost crabs,
mm-hmm.
and they will grab them and take them into their burrows. And also we have to watch out for the gulls. We've got a type of gull called a laughing gull. And
yes.
It was interesting to hear your opening story about the grizzly bears. It's one of the problems we've got is that people take to feeding the gulls, and
uh-oh.
They become habituated, yes. So when we've got a hatchling release, these gulls come around expecting a handout of food, and when they don't go and find that, then they'll try to take a nab at our hatchling turtles. So we've got to go to a lot of extra work and precautions to protect these turtles during the release to make sure none are lost to these gulls. And I just wish we could get the message out to people, please do not feed these gulls because it's just not good for the gulls or good for the turtles or even good for them because a lot of times, you know, these gulls will leave a little dropping on them or even take their sandwich right out of their hand.
Well, the dropping might be a good payback, but but that only makes sense because when you have these congregation of these folks to watch the sea turtle release, the gulls are thinking, well, it's time to go have lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, these
well,
folks are...
Go
ahead.
I've had to put on the announcement now. We've got a recorded message called the Hatchling Hotline. 24 hours a day, people can call to get the latest information on the release. And on the hotline, I have to say, please don't bring any food to the release, just because the gulls may think that they could get a handout there. So, yeah, it's a problem.
Well, what is the hotline number?
It's 361, area code in the U.S., 949 7163, and it's a recorded message available 24 hours a day. And again, our releases are over for this year, but as it gets closer to the season for next year, that's the number that they call to get the specifics on the next release that's going to be upcoming. The general schedule for the releases is posted on the website after we start finding nests. Of course, we can't project when that will be until we start finding the nests. What I tell people, and I get a lot of, each year there's some entertaining calls where people say, well, I'm going to be here on such and such a day, and I want to see a hatching release that day. And I'm like, well, this is nature. I don't have hatchlings on demand. And so you've got to work with the turtle schedule. So.
You know, the human race.
Donna, I'd like to ask you a question about the turtle imprinting. A few weeks ago, we reported a story about several hatchlings were killed because they headed for a parking lot light or a house light.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, when the turtles hatch and there's no lighting, there's no moon, it's cloud covered, how do they imprint? How do they know?
The turtles that emerge at night travel in response to light. They will go to the brightest area, and it will be on the nights where there's a nice full moon, the moon over the water, or the illumination of the waves with the light from either the stars or from the moon. The water is generally lighter than is the background and the landward side. But that equation can change if you've got lights from condominiums or from highways. And the misorientation, the turtles heading towards those man-made light sources can be a big problem. So in the loggerhead nesting beaches in particular, many of those have lighting ordinances to try to control those light sources. For our situation with Kemp's Ridley, for one, we're at the national park, so we've got very, very little lighting for those hatchlings that go into the water at night. But also, interestingly, many of the Kemp's Ridley hatchlings make their trek to the sea during the early morning hours, and that's when our public releases are held, at about 6:30 to 6:45 in the morning when it's daylight.
That helps considerably, I'm sure.
It does. It makes it easier to have the public there safely without any worries of the hatchlings getting underfoot and inadvertently.
So the sunrise or the sunset doesn't affect their...
The sunrise will be the... It's interesting, in the early morning before the sun is up above the horizon, if it's still dark and cloudy and the turtles are cool, they haven't quite gone into what's a very active state called a frenzy, I'll describe in the morning. If they haven't gone into that quite yet, the sun starts to rise, the turtles get a little warm, they look up and see the sun, and then they'll start to move and go right into the water. But the normal time for the turtles to go into the water is when they get in this very active state called a frenzy. And in a natural situation, you can envision the hatchlings are all, they're not they're working together as a conscious collective unit, but they're doing, in general, the same thing, kind of scrambling to get up to the top in a very active state, and it helps tamp the sand down, and then they come up through, and then they all scoot down towards the water in a very active state.
I found what was incredible is that the volunteers, they'll first rake the beaches of thick seaweed covering the sand, because that's, obviously for these turtles to try and fight through that seaweed, they need every chance that they could get. That would expel a lot of energy.
It would. We don't want them to unnecessarily have to go through that. The Kemp's Ridley hatchlings are slower and weaker than are the hatchlings of the loggerheads or green turtles, and considerably slower and weaker. And so we don't want them to have to fight through the seaweed. And that's another reason why it's important for us to find the nest, is because left unprotected on the beach, if the hatchlings made it at all up through the sand, then they would have to go through that thick mat of seaweed. And many of the years we have a lot of seaweed on our beaches in South Texas, and that would be really hard on them. Take a lot of energy as well as many would be lost to predators along the way.
Being the turtle mom, I mean, it has to be quite rewarding, but it has to bring a tear to your eye, hoping that these youngsters are successful and grow into their adulthood.
Well, it is very rewarding. I've been really so fortunate to have worked with these incredible animals over the course of my career. When I first started working with Kemp's Ridley, the population was plummeting. Some feared that it might already be too late. And thanks to the work of so many people in Mexico and in the U.S., that has been turned around, and the population is increasing. It's still endangered, still highly endangered, but it's increasing now. So the work is tremendously rewarding to me, but every release is special. That every release is a little bittersweet as well, because I know there's a lot of perils out there, and it'll just be a small fraction of them that will make it and will come back to nest at 10 to 15 years for maturity for this species.
10 to 15 years.
Yes.
Wow.
And
so do you take lots of pictures?
Even longer.
Oh, I'm sorry?
And some sea turtles are even longer, like the green turtles, 30 to 50 years to reach maturity. But we take a lot of pictures at the hatchlings. Most of them, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between the different individuals. They look a lot alike, but they're all special and important to us, though. And we do take a lot of pictures, and we're asked by a lot of media. We get a lot of interviews from all sorts of levels and provide a lot of photos to people that help talk about the turtles, and that's wonderful because we want to help inform folks from all over the country and all over the world about Kemp's Ridley and what they can do to help.
Are any of the turtles marked or anything put on them so that years later you can see one that may have been a success?
The hatchlings are not marked. The nesters are marked with metal flipper tags as well as those glass encapsulated tags called pit tags that are so often used in pets now.
Oh.
All of the nesting females are tagged with the little pit tags and their flippers. But those pit tags are still too large to safely put in a Kemp's Ridley hatching. Those hatchlings are very small.
Right.
Their flippers are just really thin. Not much thicker than a piece of thin, like a file folder, cardboard. So there's really not a good way to tag the hatchlings. But we are taking DNA samples from the dead embryos from the nests. And someday, if there's funding, we may be able to tell through some linking back to those previous nests of returns, but not directly through tags.
Is it easy as the hatchlings? Is it easy to tell male from female? Is there a particular characteristic?
No. For the adults, you can tell by the tail length.
Uh-huh.
But for the hatchlings, and this is a problem with the early years of the project, because it's called temperature dependent sex determination, as it was being learned about more and more for reptiles and for sea turtles in particular. We were not able to sacrifice any of these turtles, obviously, because of their highly endangered status, to find out if they were male or female. So we had to link our temperatures with the gonads from the dead individuals, because you can't tell from the hatchlings if they're male or female. So when we were trying to produce the right sex ratios, it took a long time to make sure we were on the right track by looking at dead individuals.
Well, that's interesting because in the freshwater turtles, you can determine the sex by the length of the tail. So I find that quite fascinating that it falls true with the sea turtles as well.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And for the males, the plastron is concave, the adult males.
Just like freshwater turtles.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And the females is just a flat plastron.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Oh, that's interesting. Well, there you go. Dr. Day, I've learned that tonight. And I wasn't aware of that as well.
Laura?
I just think this is absolutely fascinating. You know, we've had a lot of people on with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I would have to say that she probably are right top on the list of being one of the most dedicated employees of the National Park Service. And this work that you're doing down there, Donna, it's God's work, and it's absolutely outstanding. And I think anyone that now, of course, we're so attuned to the television, but there's documentaries on sea turtles that if they see a Kemp's Ridley sea turtle on television, that they should just think to themselves, that could be possible, because that's probably possible because of the work of Donna Shaver and also the folks at Padre Island National Seashore, because you don't do it for the money. I mean, you have to be totally dedicated to this, or this would not be a success.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
And you're very humble, I can tell. And you also know a big troublemaker down there that we've had on the show before. I mean, a character in himself, Billy Sandifer.
Well, I sure do. Billy is a good friend and so knowledgeable about the island and very enthusiastic, and he's found some nests for us, and he's actually even been hired on a few occasions by some folks who were hoping to see a nest in Kemp's Ridley, and he took them down the island on one of his just magical guiding trips of where he can describe the history, the birds, the environment, and some folks were hoping that they would get to see nesting Kemp's Ridley turtle, and by golly, they got lucky. So I think
really?
As time goes on and our nesting numbers go up, he's going to get more and more opportunities to do that, and I think it's great.
Well, it's kind of like the wildlife of Africa. What a tourism mecca. Because, you know, people around the world, as you've said, they come in from all across the country to watch these turtle releases for generations, that this definitely has to help the economy of Padre Island, Texas. And it's kind of a, you know, the good karma of releasing the turtles and going to that, the hard work that you folks do also in respect actually helps the local economy.
Well, it is. The turtles are becoming an increasing source of ecotourism to the area. Just recently, we had a water tower on North Padre Island that was installed, and what's painted on it is the Kemp's Ridley sea turtle, and it's become an increasing focus for the area, and we're thrilled about it. It's good for the program, and it's good for the people, for the local economy, and we can do this in a way where the turtles can be protected. They have to be released anyway. Why not invite the public to come out to safely watch those releases, and someday, hopefully also in increasing numbers, to come watch the nesters as well.
Well, education is key, and you're doing such a marvelous job, you and the folks down there, that, as we mentioned earlier, it's truly a great honor to have you on the program tonight. If you would please, once again, give that website. Of course, I invite our listeners around the world to just Google Donna Shaver, S-H-A-V-E-R, and sea turtles, and you'll find gobs of information about the work that she's done. But what is that website that our listeners can go to?
Mm-hmm. It's the website for Padre Island National Seashore, and it's www.nps.gov/PAIS.
Well, it's been an honor. I would love to have you back on the program, especially when we get into the when you're hard at work with those babies and find out the progress, so everyone can keep up to date on what's going on down there. Would you be willing to come back?
I would be thrilled to come back. Please just give me a call, and I will be glad to.
Well, it's been an honor, and it's been a pleasure. What a fantastic show. Donna Shaver with the National Park Service and protection and basically saving the existence of the Ridley sea turtle. We want to remind everybody next week on the program, Billy Yake from Oregon is going to be on. He just had a recent expedition over to Indonesia, the Sulawesi Island, used to be known as the Celebes Island. Had a great fascination with that, so we've invited him on the program, and it's going to be a great hour, so we hope you have a chance to join us. And a week after, Bill Munns from Hollywood, California. He's quite the interesting character. He's also in the movie business, has worked with wildlife in the movies, and also we're going to talk about his work on the film from many years ago called Quest of Fire. So we'll be looking forward to that. Big thank you to Dr. Henry Day for monitoring the Wild World News. Also, a big thank you to Melissa and Wayne for manning the chat room and keeping this program on the air. That's sometimes quite a feat in its own self. And have a great week, everybody. This is Larry Batson, and you've been listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.